Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode where we're going to be talking about the unity of science. I just realized as I went live that I forgot to ask the correct pronunciation of your first name as well, because it's like, is it like the Scandinavian pronunciation of Thomas or Thomas?
That's exactly right, Nathan. Thanks. I call myself Thomas half of the time, so no worries.
So I'm here with the author of the Unity of Science Cambridge Elements book, Thomas Tarko, and you're the professor of metaphysics of science at Bristol University and the principal investigator of the meta science research project there. Do you want to talk a little bit about what it is that you guys do before we get into it?
Yeah, very briefly, I can mention something. So we've been having this project on the full name is the Metaphysical Unity of Science, Meta Science for short, a project funded by the European Research Council, where we look at things that are relevant for this question about the unification of the sciences. So this has been going since late 2018, so it's well in its maturity now, and there's a team of three postdocs and a PhD student, and we're looking at this question from mainly from the point of view of the various interfaces between the natural sciences. So you might start from the interface between biology and chemistry, for instance, or biochemistry, and go on to look at the interface between chemistry and physics and ask what kind of connections do these sciences have. And we're trying to apply the sort of metaphysical toolbox that we share to these case studies from the sciences. So that's kind of what the main day-to-day of the project is.
So the first question then, which is mostly for people who haven't kind of heard of the unity of science before. I mean, what is it that we're talking about here when we talk about the unity of science?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it probably gives all sorts of ideas, just the notion of unity of science. But in philosophy, it has a very specific history. So it goes back to this project that was perhaps set in motion by logical empiricism and positivist and the Vienna Circle, but they didn't really use this notion of unity of science. It's Oppenheim and Putnam's famous paper from 1958, where this sort of title gets its most famous use. I mean, it was used before that as well by people like Carnap. So what is this unity of science supposed to be? Well, the traditional idea is that it is something that explains the common background between all the sciences, or that's the ideal anyway. So often this is connected with reduction, the notion of reduction, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit, gives a sort of hierarchical view of reality, where you might start from the higher level sciences, let's say psychology, economics, and go to biology, chemistry, and end up with fundamental physics. And the thought might be that you might be able to explain all that's going on in these various sciences just by referring to fundamental physics in the end. So that's the sort of extreme reductionist idea that goes together often with the notion of unity of science. Now, with the same breath, I must say that nowadays, this type of idea is, of course, very unpopular. And not very many people at all would hold to this sort of old idea of unity of science. So it has a bit of a bad name, maybe. But what I try to show in this element, I think I have a physical copy here as well that I can advertise.
Nice.
What I try to show is that there's still room for unity of science, the notion of unity of science, if it's understood in a bit more liberal fashion. And there's a lot of work actually now coming out that tries to bring this notion back and understand it in a sort of more acceptable way.
So hopefully we'll get on to some of those reasons that people might resist unity of science projects, because I think a lot of people might have an understand, you know, think, well, clearly the sciences, you know, they're all talking about the same thing, they all line up. So hopefully we'll make clear what some of those, what some of the arguments for and against are as we go through. But firstly, then, could you just talk to a bit of the history then behind these unity of science projects? So you mentioned logical empiricism or logical positivism. I mean, what were the ideas that were kind of driving some of these programs, and how did they fall out of fashion, bringing us to sort of where we're situated today?
Yeah, good. It is important to sort of see where this tradition was coming from. It was very much a reaction in philosophy and philosophy of science in particular against a kind of a looser way of doing science. Now, I'm not an expert on the philosophy of science of the historical period here, but it was pretty clear that there was a search for rigor, a new search for rigor, and a sort of a separation of a certain type of way of doing philosophy, really, which conceived to be more connected to the empirical sciences in particular. So hence the connection to empiricism. And it's in this context that the idea of a unity of science started to appeal attractive to a lot of people. People like Carnap in particular, who wanted to really criticize this type of metaphysical tradition as well that was taking hold in continental philosophy earlier in particular. So there was a sort of appeal to the tools of logic and empirical rigor that was connected to this project in philosophy of science. This idea was to begin with was that you could use these simple rules of inference, of deductive reasoning, deductive and nomological explanation that is familiar from Hempel's model of deductive nomological explanation, where you could follow the laws of logic and derive some of these higher level truths, some of the truths of the so-called special sciences, from the lower level truths, so ultimately things like fundamental physics. So that was the sort of guiding idea, and this was then connected to work that Ernst Nagel did later in particular, which I think we might touch on a little later too.
So in terms of talking about different ways of looking at unity or disunity, you sort of broadly divide the available models into two categories. So the first of which are ontological models of unity. Could you sort of introduce what ontological models of unity or disunity might be? What are the available options here, and what do we mean by it?
Yeah, I think it's important to get this straight at the outset, because this is not a traditional distinction that was made. I mean, it's to be derived from the old discussions on unity of science, but a lot of it was not really focused on ontology or metaphysics, but rather about our theories, our scientific theories in particular. So when people talk about unification, especially now, they often have in mind not an ontological model, but an epistemic or theoretical model, which I can talk about a little bit more detail. But my own interests are more on what we might call an ontological model of unity, which really is to ask about the real world, about the world and relations, as to what connects the different kinds of entities. So there's a very obvious way in which we might think that the world, the world that the science studies is unified, which is to say that, everything's ultimately made of fundamental particles, and these compose larger things, molecules, ultimately multicellular organisms, and the conscious lives of us all. So there's clearly some sort of a compositional connection going on here. And that would be to say that there's some sort of an ontological connection between these different things as well. Maybe this is what composition relations are looking at. So higher level things composed of lower level things. So that would be one way to give an ontological model of unity, to just say that, well, things are unified by this compositional dependence or compositional relation.
And then models of disunity, like ontological models of disunity, what are the kind of claims that people who hold to those models are making?
Yeah, good. So people do talk about the disunity of science now, and I guess that is a pretty popular way of thinking of this as well. And you could connect this with the notion of pluralism as well, of those pluralism is used in many contexts. But in this context, the disunity or pluralistic framework is appealing to some people. I'll mention just one name. John Dupree has defended this type of view, the philosopher of biology. What people have in mind when they talk about the disunity of sciences here in the ontological sense is that you can't really connect the different sciences by looking at one relation like this. So there's some ways in which some of the higher level special sciences are independent or autonomous of the lower level. And certainly it would be entailed that you can't derive the higher level truths from the lower level truths in the way that perhaps Nagel and some earlier proponents of the unity of science might have thought. So there isn't this sort of a clear explanatory or explanatory connection or derivability of the higher level truths from the lower level. Now, there are other questions we could ask about this. So one thing might be to say that the higher level sciences somehow emerge from the lower level sciences, but they're still dependent on them. But we can touch on that a bit later as well, maybe.
Sure. So you said a lot of people might think about this in an epistemic or pragmatic sense. So what is that distinction then? Because the ontological sense, I suppose, seems quite intuitive to think, you know, stuff is just composed of more fundamental stuff and it kind of builds up. So what would this epistemic and pragmatic way of thinking about things be, or a model of unity that's epistemic or pragmatic?
Yeah. So on the face of it, it might be to say that all the sciences, if they are unified in terms of their epistemic endeavors, they are sort of focused on discovering the same kind of set of truths. But in practice, where you see this happening is more on what we might call a type of theoretical unification. So you see this happening a lot in fundamental physics as well. So it's sort of a unification in the realm of that one science. So you might be looking for a unified theory of the fundamental laws, and that would be a type of an epistemic or pragmatic endeavor as well. So you're trying to explain some laws in terms of some other laws, and this could happen in one level, or it could happen between the levels as well. So you might be interested in explaining some chemical phenomena in terms of quantum mechanics. So look at quantum chemistry. So that would be a type of unification of unifying the methods or the practice of chemistry with that of physics, to simplify matters a little bit. There's pragmatic elements related to all of this, of course, but you might just think that on a very simple way of looking at it pragmatically is that all the sciences share in a certain type of scientific method at the very least. So you could have a sort of very weak sense of unity derivable from this. And then we could have different kinds of approaches in sort of a subspecies of epistemic or pragmatic approaches as well.
So I think for a lot of people, they sort of understand this conception in philosophy of model building, maybe more than the kind of seeking for necessary and sufficient conditions. When I talk to people who are coming from other disciplines, the model building seems to make more sense to them. But mm-hmm. what are the kind of data points that we're trying to build a model to fit when it comes to unity of science? So I suppose there's like laws and things like that, or the things that the kind of entities that the science is investigating. Could you speak to what the data is that there is to fit, and sort of maybe a little bit of where some models maybe do a bit of a better job at fitting to some of these things, or some might do a bit of a worse job because there might be these edge cases?
Good. Now you mentioned laws, and I think that's probably what almost all these accounts of Unity would start with. So we wanna give a sense in which the laws of the fundamental or more fundamental sciences are connected to those of the high level sciences, the special sciences. And the question would then be, well, are there any genuine special science laws that aren't reducible to the lower level laws? So are they in some sense independent of the lower level? And that same question can then be asked about other types of phenomena as well. So you could ask, are there any higher level properties that are genuinely not reducible to the lower level properties? Or are there any higher level natural kinds that aren't reducible to lower level natural kinds? Now, when I say natural kind, I'll just add that often people talk about it in the sense that almost anything could count as a kind. So gold is a classic example. Water is another classic example. But Fodor, for instance, talks about money as a natural kind. So that would be a higher level kind. And a lot of people might question whether it's a natural kind, whether it's independent of our own interests and activities in the sort of sufficiently objective way. So Fodor would argue that something like natural kind, something like money is a high level natural kind, and it has genuine laws governing it. So he mentions a law of economics, Gresham's law, that governs economical activities. And these would be the sort of main data points that we would be looking at, I guess, whether there would be truly independent higher level laws, properties, kinds, really whatever you're interested in.
And in terms of some of the main difficulties for unity, arguments in favor of disunity are going to maybe focus on presumably psychological phenomena, maybe because it seems more difficult to reduce those. Is that the general trend, or where do the interfaces seem to line up a bit better as well between the sciences?
Yeah, good. So you're absolutely right to say that consciousness would be a good target here. So this is, I guess, one of the traditional reasons why someone would resist the unity of science thesis. So Fodor has a couple of famous papers on this, and he's clearly, I mean, he mentions things like money, but he's clearly interested m mainly in conscious phenomena, or things like pain, the experience of pain, and other mental states or belief states, things like this. So a lot of people who resist or argue against the sort of classic unity of science thesis would want to uphold mental states as an irreducible or emergent or genuine higher level feature. But that's not all. There are people who defend, for instance, the independence of chemistry over physics. So Robin Hendry, a good friend of mine up in Durham, has defended that chemistry is strongly emergent, so not reducible to physics. Now, this is controversial, but that's just to say that there are people who defend this. Similarly, in biology, or things like evolutionary explanation, or the biological function of certain kinds of things like proteins, for instance, people have held and still argue in favor of their independence from the lower level goings on in one way or another. So I guess, I mean, you asked about the success of these different models as well. So just to very briefly answer that, I guess that there's been much more success in reducing or explaining, for instance, chemical phenomena in terms of the underlying physics, which isn't really surprising, because the more complexity you build in, you go to biology, you go to psychology, the more variables there are to consider, and the less mature the science is in some ways to answer these questions. How might consciousness be related to the underlying neurochemistry? Well, people are studying this, but if you wanted to defend a strong form of unity of science, you might think that the science isn't mature enough to answer these questions.
Something I was just thinking as well that could be a good part of this question is, in terms of comparing models, I mean, how does that discussion look in the Unity of Science space? Because it presumably it seems like it might be easier to deny that something that should be a data point is a legitimate data point that a model has to account for. You know, someone might say, well, this is a natural kind. And you might say, well, my model doesn't account for that, but that's because, so I don't think that's a natural kind of thing. And then it becomes more difficult to focus solely on the sort of virtues of the different models that people are building. I mean, typically, how do people pick between models? Is it just looking at the virtues? Is there any kind of principled set of reasons that people can appeal to for saying, you know, that this has to be a natural kind, or this isn't, you know, I'm going to resist it because I'm more committed to my model being the right one than I am to, you know, that thing being a natural kind or whatever.
Wow, that's a good question.
Sorry, there's a lot in there. Yeah, it might be a bit.
No, that's a very good question, but I think it's also a very difficult one to answer, because you'll find that people are very trenched in their sort of positions. So I mean, there isn't as much of changing from one model or opinion to another as you might maybe hope. That's not to say that there aren't, you know, data points that we can agree on and that we could convert people to another position. And of course, I like to think that all of this is continuous with the empirical sciences. So I think that we can get data points from the empirical sciences that convert us to believe that something is reducible or indeed isn't reducible. Now, having said that, I think it's much easier to get evidence for the reducibility of something than it is to get evidence for the irreducibility of something, because you never really know what the future science is going to tell you about this. Now, but from the history of science, we can get good examples. You know, people thought for a long time that vitalism, the doctrine of vitalism, is sort of a higher level science in its own right. So there's a vital force that explains, something about living organisms. We don't have to go into the details, but it suffices to say that that biology has replaced a lot of the notions that were used in that tradition of vitalism. And I mean, the same thing could happen elsewhere. To mention just one other thing, I think an important factor in deciding whether something is supposed to count as a natural kind or not is what is called predictability in this debate. So this is just to use a bit of a simple way of thinking this is the ability for us to predict explain patterns in data. So typically, you'd say that this type of predictability is a sign of causal influence. And if you think that causation is a genuine phenomenon, then you might think that this is what latches you on to what's happening in the real world. So if a postulated higher level kind or property is causally influential, then it could be deemed real. Now, this is going back to some popular doctrines in history of philosophy as well. Now, the problem with this, very briefly, is that often it's difficult to say what exactly is having the causal influence. So whether we could explain the causal influence in some other ways. Oh, that's your next question. This is perfect.
Well, I thought I'd pop it up because if it's come up, I want people just to be able to kind of see the questions underneath as we go. So is there a sort of convenient example of this projectability then that you could give for people just to sort of flesh that out a bit more?
Yeah, I mean, you could really think of any kind of law of nature. They would give us these sort of tools to project. Let me take one that Hempel uses. All gases expand when heated under constant pressure. So something like this would give us reasons to think that we can make a universal generalization, and there's some sort of law-like explanation involved. And when there is this type of a law-like explanation going on, then we can make predictions about the future behavior of those gases, you know, something like the ideal gas law. Now, maybe it's, I wonder if it's good to imagine a problematic case as well at this point. So, well, we might return to this. So I'm thinking of the debate that Fodor and Kim had later on about these sort of cases. But yeah, so I think it's good to think of this idea of projectability just as an ability to make predictions, which are somehow tied to the causal background.
And could you speak to the sense in which people often say natural kinds carve nature at the joints? And I think for modern people, it's sort of difficult to understand what that might mean. I think maybe that makes more sense in a kind of Aristotelian or Platonic framework. And I don't mean to be dogmatic and just sort of rule those out. But I think most people sort of find the idea of things having kind of like essences or something a bit sort of spooky or something. But so in a more kind of naturalistic framework, what does a natural kind mean? And then maybe you could talk about, you know, if there are contemporary versions of Aristotelianism or Platonism that seem, you know, more plausible as well for providing natural kinds.
Good. Yeah. I'll be using the notion of natural kind a little bit already here, of course. But my own view of it is sort of traditional. So I'm sympathetic to a type of Aristotelian view about natural kinds. Well, what we might think is Aristotelian view about natural kinds. But the notion is used very liberally nowadays. So I think it's helpful to distinguish between what we might call natural kind terms or just kind terms and what are supposedly genuine natural kinds. So we used kind terms, you know, we talk about cars and pencils and all sorts of things, artifacts that we've created. Now, most people would agree that at least these aren't natural in the intended sense because we've created them. So sometimes you might appeal to mind independence when you're talking about this, but that natural kinds carve at nature at its joints. So you might think that a genuine natural kind has to be somehow independent of our activities or interests in this sort of way.
The other part of the question was sort of like, so what, I mean, what's the sense in which these things sort of genuinely carve nature at its joints, so to speak, which is what you often hear people say who talk about natural kinds?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, again, that's a good question.
But very difficult. Well,
so I mean, the joint carving analogy goes back to Plato. So it has a venerable history, but people use it in all sorts of ways nowadays. But I think that the core is there, that is supposed to be there, is just the idea that there is a level of objectivity or indeed mind independence, which is difficult to specify, I should say, the mind independence of a natural kind as well. I have a paper on this that hopefully I can cite at some point. I mean, not to get too bogged down with this notion of joint carving itself. It's supposed to be something that is worldly. It's out there. It's not just our decision. You know, we can decide that something is a kind, and this is what we would do with artifactual kinds all the time, right? So we say that there's something in common with all of these pencils. Well, what's in common with them? Well, you can write with them. Well, that's a function. So that would be a functional kind. But I think that not all functional kinds certainly are natural kinds in the intended sense, because there's nothing, the world doesn't, as it were, do anything to make pencils homogeneous in this way. It's our decision that, well, anything that you can write with is a pencil or is a writing tool, pen, whatever. Same goes with chairs or tables or what have you.
Yeah, it definitely does help. But the next thing that comes up is sort of like how it is that we can tell the difference then between, you know, these artificial kinds and genuine natural kinds. Because I mean, you talked a little bit about projectability when I popped this question up, but it sort of seems to me, I don't know, like there are plausible candidates maybe for projectable things that pens can do, you know, like okay, if it's a pen, it will be able to do X, Y, and Z or something like that. And but I don't want to say that pens are genuine natural kinds, you know, in the same sense that maybe like muons or electrons or something are. So, I mean, how can we tell the difference between genuine natural kinds or sort of artificial ones?
Yeah, good. I think that's a key question really in this debate. And I mean, there are many, many potential answers to it. But one of them is certainly tied to this idea of projectability or causal influence. For instance, Muhammad Ali Khalidi has a nice book on this. I think I even have it here. Natural Categories and Human Kinds, where he defends this type of view, where it's really natural kinds are the causal nexus of the world. So this is where causal influence meets in some way. But I think we can take a step back, because this type of question comes up already in this debate between Kim and Fodor that I mentioned briefly. Maybe now is a good time to mention an example from there, because
so if you want to just maybe would it be better to segue through the Nagelian model to Kim and Fodor and talk about the jade and nephrite stuff, or do you want to talk? I don't mean to interrupt your train of thought if you've got a good example in your mind now.
Yeah, I'm tempted to introduce this example from Kim, because I think it illustrates this quite nicely, and we can then see if we return to this. So this is not going to take too long necessarily, because the idea is very simple. It's that Kim mentioned this case of jade that you just said, where jade is being realized or reduced to jadeite or nephrite. So jade is a mineral kind, but it turns out there's two different types, jadeite and nephrite, and they're all called jade. And what Kim proposed is that, well, this is a case where we have a supposed special science law. We can say jade is green, and we can make generalizations from that, but it doesn't seem that, according to Kim, that it captures the right type of influence, the type of that we were just searching for. Because really, what you're saying when you say jade is green, what you're really saying is either jadeite is green or nephrite is green, depending on your instance of jade at hand. You know, you might have a piece. Always when I talk about this, I wish I had a jade artifact as a prop, but they're quite expensive. When you have a piece of jade in your hand, you say, well, jade is green, or this piece of jade is green. What you're really saying is jade is green or nephrite is green. I mean, the example is stupid because jade comes in many colors anyway, but let's leave that to one side. Kim didn't seem to realize that. But the point is then that what we have there is not a genuine natural kind, according to Kim, really, even though it looks projectable at the outset. But what's not projectable there, according to Kim, is jade. Jade isn't projectable. Jade isn't the one that has the causal influence. It's either one of these realizers, jadeite or nephrite. So what we should be looking at is the lower level rather than the higher level law. So that's supposed to be a case that illustrates to us how we can tell genuine kinds from non-genuine kinds. Now, I'm not saying that this is an example that works all the way through, but I think it's a simple illustration of this. And then Kim and Fodor had this classic debate about this case.
So that might be a more natural way then of segueing into some of a few of the different ways of breaking down reduction that you talk about in the book. So the first one is this Nagelian model of reduction, and not Thomas Nagel, who everyone knows, but Ernest Nagel. And what is this idea of reduction then?
Yeah, good. We've sort of touched on this a little bit, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. But I mentioned briefly this idea of, I think, a deductive nomological model of explanation earlier. Now, that's not Nagel's model, but it's Hempel's. But it's very closely related to the Nagelian model of reduction. So the deductive nomological model is just very briefly that there's an explanandum and an explanans. So the explanandum would be a sentence, describes a certain phenomenon we want to explain, and then there's the explanans, which is some class of sentences that provides the explanation for the phenomenon. And then the deductive part of this model would be the requirement that the exponendum has to follow from the exponent's biological consequence. So this is the Hempelian model of deductive nomological explanation. The nomological part comes from something I already mentioned, which is that all gases expand when heated under constant pressure. And this is what we would be regarded as a law in this type of explanation. So we could use that law and the fact that a given sample of a gas has been heated under constant pressure and explain why the sample of gas has expanded. So this is really like a very simple model of explanation, if you like. But the Nagelian reduction takes this as a starting point, which is, I've got my book open here. I've got a nice passage from Nagel himself here on this. Maybe I just read this out. So
you can share your screen as well, I think, if you want. But don't worry if.
This is very brief. I'll just say this one thing. He says that a reduction is affected when the experimental laws of the secondary science are shown to be the logical consequences of the theoretical assumptions of the primary science. That's it. So by logical consequence, you're supposed to derive, the connection between the laws of two sciences, as it were, or two phenomena, if you like. So the basic form would just be that a theory, call it the A theory, it reduces to a theory B if and only if you can derive A from B with the help of some, Nagel calls them coordinating definitions, but they're more commonly known as bridge laws about the principle. So you have two theories, and then you have these laws that supposedly connect them, bridge laws. If you have those in place, then you can derive the other theory from the other one by logical consequence. So this is a very strong way of moving about it. And, no one would argue at this time that we could derive mental states just from some neuroscientific data. But of course, they might say, well, we don't have the bridge laws that connect the neural states and the mental phenomena yet.
Right.
So this is a very simplified way of looking at Nagelian reduction, but it is a quite simplified picture.
So in sort of tracking the progress that the dialectic makes, over the past 50 or however many years that this is taking place, what is Fodor's multiple realization objection then to these kinds of unity projects?
Yeah, good. I've predicted some of these issues already in what I've said before, but now we can kind of close the circle, because the case of Jade, of course, is something that Kim claims is a case of multiple realization. But at its simple level, let's start with the case of pain, right? So multiple realization is just the idea that the same higher level phenomenon, such as pain, can be realized by multiple different lower level phenomena. So take human pain and
octopus pain.
Octopus pain. That's the classic example. I mean, let's keep it simple. Yes, take human pain and octopus pain. This is supposed to be, of course, the same higher level phenomenon in this case, but that can be realized by two different kind of neurophysiological processes, the one in humans and the one in octopus. The thought is just that you can find a higher level phenomenon, a natural kind, if you like, you can find multiple different bases from it from the lower level. And that already blocks the sort of simple identification of the higher level and the lower level stuff. So you can't just say that pain is neurophysiological stuff of kind A, because it turns out that there's stuff kind B, which also brings forward or causes, if you like, the same type of higher level phenomenon. So this is like a very simple way of looking at it, of course, but that's supposed to block this type of old idea of unity of science as well, because you can't just proceed by logical consequence from one to the other if there's these multiple paths that you're supposed to follow. You really, really need identity to be able to follow this through.
So in terms of what's most popular for blocking unity projects, I mean, is this still sort of the main kind of boogeyman, as it were, or are other, I mean, obviously there are other arguments, but are there other sort of more popular that are seen as more forceful reasons to kind of reject unity now?
Yeah, I would still say that the multipolarization objection in its various forms, and I mean, it has been discussed a lot after Fodor as well. But I'd still say that that's the main reason. You know, if you were to ask philosophers of science now, why don't you accept theoretical reduction, identity reduction? They would probably cite, most of them would probably cite multipolarization objections or arguments. So I think that it's still the main reason to go here. I mean, there are others though. A lot of people might say, and rightly so, that just the old-fashioned model of multipolarization is itself too simplistic. So some people would just deny this type of levels thinking altogether, because the old view of unity of science is built on there being these hierarchical levels that are very strictly connected. So a lot of people would say maybe that the truth is much more messy. You know, there's all sorts of inter-level connections, and there's cross-cutting kinds, and all sorts of things that prevent, even maybe even more seriously than the multipolarization, prevent this type of reductive activity. So these are, I mean, some ways I'd say that these are just more fine-grained versions of a type of multipolarization objection, but the classic one is still forceful for many.
So I've got a couple more questions for you, and then we will move on to Q&A. So just people who are watching in the chat, if they want to put those questions now, and then we'll have them to come to in a moment. But we talked a lot about sort of ideas of reduction, but what are emergentist models of unity, and how do emergentist models differ from reductive models? So how do emergentists sort of cash out what emergence means and things like that?
Yeah, good. This is obviously a really big topic, but just to connect it to what we've been discussing, I've mentioned emergence a couple of times in passing here, and there's really, we should at the outset distinguish between weak and strong emergence. So emergence altogether is just the idea that there's some sort of autonomy of a higher level science or kind or what have you, and it depends from the lower level. That's a part of the emergentist model. It depends on the lower level, but it has a level of autonomy. Now, there are many different ways to cash out what that autonomy is supposed to amount to, but a good way, or kind of a popular way, is to say that there's some sort of new causal power or influence, which connects it back to what we've been talking about. So kind of a weak emergentist picture, which is very popular, it can be a fairly weak view, as the name suggests, is just that there's some sort of surprising or novel feature that comes about in scientific discourse, for instance, and we could say that it's weakly emergent from what's happened before, even though we kind of see how it's connected to the lower levels. So weak emergence isn't necessarily a particularly problematic view for the unity of science. I think at least if it's understood relatively weakly, you can very easily connect it with this type of idea. But the idea or possibility of strong emergence is more serious, because that is the idea that whatever new powers or kinds come about, they are totally novel. So they are not present in any format in the lower level, and we can't necessarily derive them from the lower level either. So again, consciousness is often mentioned as a potential example, but as I noted, some people might think that some of the other sciences as well have this element of strong emergence, like Robin Hendry defends in the case of chemistry. Maybe I won't try to give a more comprehensive introduction to emergence, because there are very many different approaches to it. But just the implication for the unity, the way I understand it, is that weak emergence wouldn't be a problem for the type of ontological unity that I've defended, but strong emergence potentially would be.
There's obviously so much to each of these topics, you know, that can't really just be covered in about an hour or so. But I think you're doing a good job in terms of covering this, a bit of the giving an impression of some of the breadth and depth to some of these things. So the last question then that I've got here is what do you view as some of the most promising research programs in the Unity of Science? So, I mean, this could be in terms of making progress to show, you know, clear cases of ontological reduction or reduction of different kinds that haven't been shown before, or clear cases of disunity. I mean, where does it look like we're kind of heading in your view?
Yeah, good. I mean, all of the things you mentioned would be relevant. So I guess I would start by saying that the promising research in this area isn't necessarily done under the label of a Unity of Science. And that's partially because it still has this baggage from the old, Nagelian reductive models, which are not very popular now. So I think that the most promising work is done on a case studies, really. So detailed case studies from the sciences that try to look at the connections between, proteins and their chemical basis. You know, this is stuff that I've been interested in myself. Biochemical natural kinds that seem to overlap to sort of scientific boundaries, if you like. Of course, science isn't actually layered that sharply anyway, but those sort of case studies can help us to understand, well, what it is that connects these types of kinds and these types of disciplines or phenomena into each other. So looking at those relations that supposedly, they look a little bit like the old bridge laws, but I don't think they should be called bridge laws, because they could be as simple as compositional relations or even dependence relations at the same level. So you might be looking at these sort of things just in foundational physics as well. So I think those would be the best examples. I'm interested in seeing what kind of new work is being done on the notion of reduction itself, because that also has a bit of a bad name from the history. But I think people are now starting to realize that we can distinguish between what I'm calling ontological reduction in these ontological models of science and semantic reduction or semantic eliminativism. So you might think that the higher level sciences are perfectly entitled to their language of higher level language. So we can still talk about love at the end of the day, even if it were to be ontologically reducible to some lower level goings on.
And just briefly, being an advocate of unity yourself, what do you think is sort of the strongest element for concern for your position? You know, what is there anything that you look at and you sort of think, oh no, you know, that looks quite promising in the disunity camp, as it were?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that I'm not too worried about any of this, because I'm willing to kind of go where the data shows, despite mentioning the entrenched positions before. Yeah. Entrenched positions before. But I guess I would be. I think that where I would need to do more work to understand how the model of unity that I prefer works is in the realm of process ontology, the type of process views in biology, for instance, defended by Chen Dupree, who I mentioned before, who are strong proponents of disunity. And one of the reasons is that you have to understand life according to this sort of biological phenomena, according to this